Welcome to Disc Golf History and Legends, sponsored by Blue Power Disc Golf. And here is your host, Scott Stokely.
Hi, everyone. So I am so, I'm so excited about this. This is something I've wanted to do for a while as I have aged poorly, some might say. But yeah, as I'm getting older, one of the things that's been very important to me, especially since I came back to the sport, is not wanting to lose a lot of the things that happened in the early days of the sport. Like I've said on many occasions, I believe the sport is better now than it's ever been. It's everything from the prize money, which is never enough, but to cultural recognition, to respect, to the athletes playing the game, to the quality of the tournaments, to the growing women's field. I mean, in every measurable way, the sport's better than it's ever been, and it's going to be better next year. So I am not one of those old people who believe that back in my day, things were better. I will, however, argue that back in my day, things were more interesting. The early history of the sport is, it was such a treat and such a pleasure to be a part of this. You know, I think back to the early days of baseball, like when, you know, as amazing of a sport as the sport is today, if you look at baseball in the 1800s, it was really, really weird. You know, guys used to slide in on one side because they would have a whiskey flask in their other back pocket. At least as ball players playing the game. And it was weird and not respected. And there, no one made any money at it. And your parents cried if you told them you were going to play baseball as a career. And, you know, a lot of that is kind of reminiscent of the early days of our sport. And I don't want those things to be forgotten. They're interesting to me, but I believe they're interesting to other people as well. So I want to try to bring that to everybody and try to keep that alive. And I want to get the stories of the early days. And there's so many of them, can't be done in one show. So this is going to be a weekly podcast every Wednesday. Hopefully I never get tired of it, but for the foreseeable future. Now, I have a secondary motive. I have an ulterior motive for doing this. Shoot. But I am running 10 Blue Power Disc Golf events around the country this year. And I plan on doing a lot more next year. And it just so happens, this amazing coincidence, but as it turns out, I have an event coming up on June 9th and 10th in Hayes, Kansas. And like I said, just by coincidence, the first episode is going to be the history of disc golf in Kansas. And maybe people in Kansas will tune in. Just the stars aligned, and it just happened to work out that way. But real quick, and then we'll get to our guests. The event is it's a traditional PDGA C-tier tournament. Now, this is a different type of event than the Blue Power events I've run in the past, because this is a traditional PDGA-sanctioned disc golf tournament. It's 100% payback in cash for pros, 100% payback in prizes for AMs, you know, CTPs, ace pools. You know, if you want to come out in disc golf, it's a regular disc golf tournament. Half the divisions play Saturday, half divisions play on Sunday. What makes this event different, the Blue Power component of this event, is that on Saturday, on the mostly amateur day, there's on Saturday, there's going to be a free class for kids and adults with special needs. And that is going to be open to anybody with autism or Down syndrome or blind, deaf, CP, ADHD, PTSD, kid or adult, doesn't matter. It's going to be a free introduction to disc golf. I'm going to provide all the equipment needed to play. So if you know anybody with special needs in your family, friends, coworkers, bring them out to Hayes, Kansas, 2 p.m. on Saturday for the free special needs class. Everybody gets a disc for showing up. So that's the commercial. You're going to have to listen to me talk about this at the beginning of every podcast. So that's how it's going to work. So I'm super excited. So we're going to start this series with the early history of disc golf in Kansas. And I have two incredibly amazing guests that are both pioneers in the sport of Kansas. One I know pretty well, one I know a little bit, but I've known them both for many years. The first is going to be Bill Paulson, and the second is going to be Harvey Barger. Bill is going to be just joining us on phone. But he's going to be in for audio, and Harvey's going to be on webcam. This is part of my goal. I'm going to bring in somebody who looks older than me every episode. put him up next to me on the screen, and I'm gonna like magically, I'm gonna become more youthful in comparison. So thank you for that, Harvey. So last thing. Oh my gosh, how could I forget? This is all being done courtesy of Smashbox TV. They're not charging me anything. They just want to support Blue Power. They want to support the history of the sport. Smashbox TV is donating all of their time and efforts and their software and experience to broadcast this and their audience. How can I forget them all? I'm so sorry, guys. Terry and Jonathan have been amazing, and they're behind this. Thank you, guys. So I'm counting on Jonathan to be the technical part of this, because if I did it, it would be horrible. So if we could, can we bring in Harvey and Bill? Jonathan? It worked! Hey, Harvey.
What's up, Scott?
Hey, man. And is Bill on the phone, too?
I am.
Wow. Okay, we've already nailed this. I plan on fumbling around a lot. So I am, I'm so honored to be talking to you guys. This is so amazing. I'm going to do this a little different, because mostly what's going to happen is we're going to have a conversation just chatting about the old days of disc golf in Kansas. And I'm not going to be part of a lot of that conversation. I might help direct it, but it's going to be your guys' stories, right? But I do want to tell an intro of a story of my own, of my introduction to disc golf in Kansas. And Harvey doesn't know I'm going to be telling this story, but when I was introduced to Kansas disc golf, it actually took place in Austin, or more specifically, Round Rock, Texas, in 1992. Remember this, Harvey?
Oh, yeah.
Nationals.
I still got the hat.
Okay. So here's the story. So I hadn't traveled much at this point. I'd traveled a little bit for disc golf, but I was still fairly new to I'd never been on tour. And I traveled with Leonard Muse to Round Rock, Texas for the National Pairs Championships. I mean, this is a major tournament back then. National Pairs. Doubles was, it's played today, but it was bigger back then as far as, you know, relative to singles. Doubles really meant something. And the very first hole of the National Pairs Championships, I get on the box. Well, Leonard and I get on the box with Harvey Barger and Bart Patton. And Bart, also from Winfield, Kansas. And these guys join us on the tee pad. And it's one of these horrible golf stories, right? I'm going to have to describe the hole to put this in context. And it's going to be a horrible description. But basically, you're teeing off about 10 or 15 feet from the water. The disc is landing 10 or 15 feet from the water from this lake. Important part of the story, I was told that there were water moccasins, poisonous water moccasins in this lake that'll kill you dead. So I was terrified of going in the water. So anyways, very first hole, we step up, we throw our shots. It's a really routine, easy shot. Harvey steps up to the hole. Now, you can't really throw your shot in the water, because you throw over land and there's a line of trees blocking the water. So even if you go too high, you're going to hit these trees. You're going to land on land. Harvey chooses to throw his shot over the water and attempt to crash through absolutely no window whatsoever to get to the hole. He steps up. Of course, it hits the line of trees, falls in the lake. Leonard and I just look at each other. We were shocked. It's like, this is the national championships. It's the first hole. Everybody's still in the game at this point. And he just throws this ridiculous shot over the water. So Bart steps up after him, throws the exact same route over the water. Same result, drops in the water. We're like, these guys are freaking nuts. But like, this is like my introduction to Kansas disc golfers in 1992. So we start walking to the hole, and their discs are gone as far as we're concerned, because there's poisonous, deadly water moccasins in the water. And as we're walking, Harvey and Bart keep walking towards the water. They get to the edge of the water, and without missing a beat, both of them lift their golf bags over their heads and walk into the water, shoes on, golf bags in hands, up to their shoulders in water and water moccasins to retrieve their discs. Come out, so they were soaking wet the entire rest of the round. I don't know what happened. I don't know where you guys finished. Laughing the whole time. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So this was my introduction to the spirit of disc golf back then, because they were just there to have fun purely and almost die. Anyways, don't know if that's interesting to anybody else, but that was my introduction to Kansas. That's my introduction to Harvey and Bart. I want to start with,
I would have to ask a question.
Go ahead.
You can hear me. Did the mention at the players meeting? Did Harvey mention at the players meeting that everybody come to Austin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And we did. And actually, we're going to get to October Frizz. That's the one of the most famous disc golf tournaments in the world. There's more stories from that one, too. So we're going to get to that as well, for sure. But I want to know, so Harvey, tell me what got you into disc golf and when?
We originally started playing Ultimate. A friend of mine got us into it, and we formed an Ultimate team in 1979, and we played Ultimate until 83. And a lot of the guys moved away to go, you know, they went to college and that kind of thing, and so we lost people here and there. And it was hard to keep a team together to travel. And one year we were in 83, we were in Oklahoma at Woodson Park playing an Ultimate tournament, and they have a polo course there. And we'd never seen baskets before. And I asked one of the guys from the Oklahoma team, from the Oklahoma City Jam, what are those things there? And he said, those are pohos. And I said, pohos, what do you do with pohos? And he said, you play disc golf. I'm like, what's that? So he took us out and we played with our 165. And we thought it was kind of a silly game because we were Ultimate players and really arrogant. And, you know, it's like, well, that must be for old people. But then a year or two later, we weren't playing Ultimate anymore. And it seemed like a really practical solution. So we started playing and we really started playing heavy in 84. And we played mostly in Oklahoma because there were very few courses in Kansas at that time. We had like 8 basket courses and 2 tone pole courses.
Okay. And were you in Winfield at the time?
Yes.
Okay. And what about you, Bill? When did you start and how did you get into it?
I was introduced to a Frisbee in 1975 when I was in service in Germany and played off and on over there. But then when I got back and started going to school, after settling in, I needed some exercise to get rid of some, the old belly, get in shape. So I signed up for the school Ultimate team, and luckily there were no tryouts. I didn't have to qualify or anything, because probably wouldn't have, but played Ultimate for the Pitt State team. And then one day after practice, some guy said, hey, let's go golf. And I said, guys, I don't have any clubs. And they just laughed at me. And so we went and played disc golf. Of course, back in those days, everything was object golf, throwing at trees and light poles and statues and that sort of thing. I just asked the silly question, why are we playing Ultimate when we can do this? That's how I got into it.
That's amazing. By the way, this is all brand new to me. So I got a second computer up where I'm going to follow chat. So when people have questions, I can do this. It may turn out to be a 2-person job, but I'll be trying. So this is one of the things that I think a lot of people don't, I mean, it may be understood, but back in the early days, the sport was called Frisbee. And you played Frisbee. It wasn't even disc sports. You played Frisbee, but there was an offshoot over time, different games started being developed. With Frisbees, Ultimate being one of the big ones, disc golf being the big ones. There were a number of other Frisbee events that were just as big or bigger back then. You know, I mean, if you had gone back to 1975, you probably would have predicted guts, you know, where you stand 15 meters apart and throw Frisbees at each other as hard as you can. Like, that was probably had a brighter future than disc golf in the early days, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah.
It was big up in the Chicago area where, you know, people stayed indoors and could throw indoors, you know, because of the harsh winters. But in this area, while we had guts tournaments, I would say they were all just about equal. The Frisbee tournaments were Frisbee tournaments. No telling what they would have, whether it was double disc court, guts, disc golf. Ultimate tournaments tended to be their own thing because of how much time and effort it took. But at Frisbee tournaments, you never knew what you would find. Field events. Harvey's thrown so many events. He can tell you. You know, the MTA, the throw, run, and catch, you know, distance, accuracy, all kinds of things like that.
Double disc court.
Yeah. So what about I mean, nowadays, a disc golf course, I mean, you see a mixture of people, but you see a lot of families. You see a lot of, you know, what you'd call real athletes training. It wasn't always like that back then. What do you guys remember about the people that used to come out and play back in the early days?
Yeah, you know,
What was that, Bill?
It was all about having fun.
Yeah.
As a camaraderie with the other people.
You think now? Go ahead.
Some of my greatest friends are from disc golf. I've known them since I started playing, and you know, it's such a joyful group, and everyone's willing to help each other out. I mean, whenever you go anywhere, you end up staying with someone, you know, and avoid a hotel bill, and they show you their side of the town, and it's just it's a big family. That's the thing that I always loved about it. Everyone seemed like-minded, you know. We all had the same appreciation for being outdoors and being together.
Hello. Now, what about... Go ahead.
I was just agreeing.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's... one of the things that I think brought us together back then was that you were an outcast if you played this sport. You know, I mean, like we right? I mean, is that an accurate description?
Well, you know, I'll tell you one thing that always got me was whenever you would tell someone you were going to go golf, they'd go, "Oh, really?" And you'd go, "Well, yeah, disc golf." And they'd go, "Disc golf?" And you go, "Well, frisbee golf." And they'd go, "Oh." I mean, how many times in my life I go, "Oh." And it's like, well, yeah. Bring your butt out and try it, you know? I mean,
yeah.
It's just... It's,
well, that's if they had even heard of it.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
You had to explain what it was to everybody.
Oh, yeah.
So what about that? So now, specific to Kansas, from what I was reading, I tried to do a little bit of my own, but you guys know far better, is that there were... two or three courses that went in the ground before the one in Hayes, but those two or three are no longer there or have been completely modified? Or like, what was the first hole course? And no, I'm sorry. What was the first recognized course? It didn't have to have baskets, but the first course where you could go out and a number of different people say knew the course.
Well, to my knowledge, according to what Ed told me, the first course he laid out in Lindsberg. And those baskets are in Winfield now. The college took them out.
Really?
Of the ground. We used to borrow. Yeah, we borrowed them every year for the frizz. And we'd go up there and bring them down and use them, then take them back. Well, we went up one year to get them. Dave went up to get them, and they weren't there. And he was starting to come back, but he just drove around the campus for no particular reason. And he saw them all in a pile, in the scrap metal pile. So he went in and asked the maintenance supervisor what they were going to do with them. And they said, "We're done with them." And he said, "Well, can I take them? Because we're going to use them for the frizz, you know." And the guy goes, "Yeah, go ahead and take them." And Dave signed a note and told him he had them. And then I called the athletic director after the frizz and said, "You want us to bring the baskets back?" And he said, "No, keep them. We know where they're at." And I said, "Okay." So we saved them from the heat. But now they put a new course in. And it's kind of it's a neat little course, but there's a couple of scary holes, and where you got to be real careful not to throw at people, and that might pop out. So it's not the same. The original course, when Ed laid it out, it was just a wide open field, and then slowly the college developed around it, and they put in a handball court, and they put in some baseball diamonds, and they put in the stadium for football. So whereas before you were throwing across an open field, now you threw across an open field to a basket that was a foot behind the backstop of the softball diamond. And then you had one where you stood outside of the stadium fence and threw 300 feet down to the basket being a foot inside of the fence. So it was like, and the bleachers were on the right side. So you had a little narrow window that you could not hit. You either had to go out over the bleachers and try and get all the way clear of them, or throw out in the street and hit the fence, and then you just bring it in from where it touched the OB line. So it was a crazy course. It would destroy your discs. It was really fun. We played it every year in PGA.
My thing cut out. What was this course again?
It was in Lynchburg on the Bethany campus.
Okay. Gotcha.
1977.
Ed said he put that in 75, I was thinking.
77.
There you go.
Gotcha. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Bill.
That was the first basket course. But there were other courses around the state that were object courses. One on the Wichita State campus that was started in 74, maybe 75. And there were others up in the Northeast. And there was one on the campus of Pitt State. There was one on the campus. So they were mostly on campus.
Gotcha. Yeah, back in the old days, that's what the courses were. I mean, the idea of spending $5,000 to put a course in was huge. I mean, not a lot of parks departments were going to sign off on that, because that's a lot of money for a city or a school for something that they'd never heard of before.
Right.
To give you an example, I went out, this is not Kansas, but when I first played what became the Masters Cup, I think it was called the World Cup, in Santa Cruz in, oh God, I think it was 87. This is De La Vega, the world famous De La Vega disc golf course. It was four baskets and 14 poles. And the reason there were four baskets was because the club was raising money to put one basket in. So they would roll with the basket. So the object and basket, because like I said, $5,000 for a course, obscene. So that's, I love that. Now, what were these mock? I mean, I assume they were Mach 1s back then. Were the Winfield baskets the original Mach 1s, or were they?
Yes.
The first baskets we got in Winfield were Mach 3s, but they were like four that I bought from Ed as they were portable. I called every business in Winfield and begged them for money, and they were, I mean, I got turned down 90% of the time, or laughed at, because they're like, yeah, right. But eventually we got the money for four of them. And then after we got those four, we took measurements off of them and thought, well, we can build these. And so we started making them, and we made several. And most of the baskets we have that we use at Frizz are baskets we made. In the early, early years, we'd take anything. We used a basket made out of bamboo one year, and the chains were pieces of rubber hose. So there was no basket. We
had a catcher. You had a cable catcher also.
Yeah, I won that in Norman in 89.
I forgot all about the catchers. Yeah, the baskets weren't, it was no guarantee it was going to be chains in the early days. And by the way, the whole idea why chains were chosen, I mean, it turns out they were a good choice for physics reasons. But the reason why Ed went with the chains is because he wanted an audio reward for making the shot. So he wanted the people to get the reward of the sound of the chains, which now, of course, that we dream of this sound in our brains. But again, that was so new back then. It was just making noise. It was weird. But Ed, whatever you say about him, he had his genius moments. That was one of them.
Yeah. There was a course. So what about in Harrington that Dennis Boschel put in, and it had one basket was a fly swatter. It was just 2-inch pipe tubing shaped like a basket that had two wires that ran down straight where the chains would be. So if you looked at it, if you came to it sideways, it was just a 2-inch pipe you were trying to hit and land in a car tire that had been flipped upside inside out and the top rim had been cut out. I mean, and those baskets, they were horrible because when you face mask, it just go thud. And it was so depressing. But every basket was different that Dennis had designed. They were some of the most ingenious designs. And, you know, I was kind of disappointed when we lost those and went with pole holes. There was some of that was neat.
The fly swatter, I think, is his mailbox post now.
Really? There you go.
Yep.
Gotcha. And back then, for those of you who don't know, the Mach 1 baskets were just like the baskets today, except they had a whopping 10 chains that hung down. So there are 10 separate chains. And this is not an exaggeration. A 15-foot putt. What?
6-inch deep basket.
Oh, yeah. 6 inches deep, 10 chains. When I was playing, when they went from 10 chains to 12 chains, no interchange at all, just from 10 to 12, that was revolutionary. Like, we couldn't believe how much better those those got. But a 15-foot putt was, I mean, that was really, really good because you had to loft it 10 feet in the air to make it go in slow enough. I mean, it was a whole different ballgame. Now, so what about, I was talking to Ron Rice, and I was sad that we couldn't get him on, but while this is all going on, disc golf is starting to be played in Western Kansas, out in Hays specifically. And I think Ron was the key to all that. Were you doing any traveling back then? Did you ever make it out west to Hays? Or?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Yeah, Hays was on the tour. When it started out, Hays had tone poles, and they were beautiful. They were like just a 2-inch pipe, and the top pipe was separated from the bottom, hung on a piece of rebar, so when you hit it, it sounded like a chime. So you could tell when you got an ace, even from way away. That was a great course. And the baskets are in the same place. But, Ron was a great guy. Ron, he was so much fun. And, you know, out there in Hays, the wind was always blowing 1,000 miles an hour. And Ron, it always seemed as if he was in some kind of a warehouse when he threw it. It would just, like, not be affected at all. You'd, like, he was, you know, unfathomable.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was reading the tournaments in the early days. I just happened to be reading about the Frontier Open, which is one of the longest running tournaments in the world. I believe Ron started that. At the first Frontier Open, I believe there were 6 players.
Right.
Probably was expecting 4 and was happy to get 6, would be my guess. I know Dennis came all the way in. But what were some of the early tournaments like back in the day?
All the ones that we played originally are still go to.
So, go ahead.
Tell him, Bill.
I was wondering what you said.
I said most of the courses we played then in the tournament are still on the tour today.
There was a national series meet up in Kansas City in 1980, I think. So that was certainly one of the early ones. And that was, they didn't use baskets. They used wire, chicken wire on the ground for baskets. and then Topeka had a tournament probably somewhere in the 80s, 84, 85, somewhere in there. And then all of the colleges had tournaments on campus on their college courses. I know WSU had them as early as the late 70s, mid to late 70s. PSU had one. I think their first one was in 1977. But once again, it was always object golf.
Gotcha. Now, at these early tournaments, go ahead.
What year was it we formed the KDGA, Bill? Wasn't that 89?
88.
Yep, 1988.
And then that year it really kicked off in 89. And that first year, the very first disc that was designed had a series of 10 baskets representing the 10 courses in the state that had basket courses. There were other courses, the object courses, private courses, but the original, in 1989, there were 10 courses in the state of Kansas with baskets, 18 hole.
Yeah, we've come a long way.
Yeah, so at these early tournaments, how many thousands of dollars did the pros win? Like, if you won a Kansas Series disc golf tournament, how many thousands of dollars did one win?
Hundreds? In 10 years.
Yeah. You won thousands of dimes.
Thousands of dimes. No, so who were the top players out there back in the 80s? I mean, and by the way, let me preface something by saying, in addition to states, I'm also going to do a series of disc golf meccas, places like Austin and Los Angeles and Charlotte, and I'm going to do a whole podcast just about Kansas City. So I'm going to be not talking as much about Kansas City when we're talking about Kansas, because I'm going to do an entire show about Kansas City.
Sure.
I want to talk about the whole state. But who were the top players back in the early days? Like, who was the one to beat?
Well, I always felt like I was not going to have a chance if Harvey showed up. So Harvey was definitely one of the ones to beat.
All right.
Steve Brown in Carolina. He was... one of the early golfers that was phenomenal. Who else, Harvey?
There were several, you know. Kevin Babbitt was a real good young golfer back then. And you know, there were several people up in the Kansas City area that we rarely got to play with. But
Bruce.
We started out in Winfield. A lot of the tournaments we went to were in Oklahoma. So I was... you had the McClellans. Come on, you had Mitch Mack and Johnny Mack and Gunner. And then you had Alvin Dale, the Iceman. I mean, there were some phenomenal golfers. Brent Edwards, some, you know, amazing people that taught me a lot, that taught me everything I learned about the game early on from them. And, you know, like a great story, Brent Edwards is no longer with us. And everybody, we called him Chief. And, I was playing one year at Woodson Park with Brent Edwards in the early 90s. And as we're walking up to this hole, Brent's telling me that there's a bird in this pine tree that will fly out and attack your disc. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. And we get up there, and Brent throws a shot, and it's a shot. It's going to play right. Never going to go in. Never going to be even close. And this bird flies out of this tree and starts tapping this disc with its feet, just like setting its feet on the disc, turns the disc towards the basket and rides it all the way to like a foot, and then peels off and slams it in for an ace. And I'm like, wow, yeah, Brent, that bird will mess with your disc. It's like, you know, I mean, that's the beauty of disc golf. You know, you can play 17 crappy holes and make one good shot on the 18th, and you want to come back and play again.
Good point. I love it. So were the McClellans, I mean, when they came up to Kansas, I mean, were they?
Oh yeah.
I mean, those guys.
If Mitch showed up, he was the man to beat.
Even when Clint was there?
Yeah. Well, Gunner and Clint, Clint and Mitch, they had a great competition between them, but Mitch seemed a little more focused than Gunner, but that dude, Mason, I've seen him make astonishing shots. We've got a video of him that he did. We were at the Frizz one year, and we were like 200 feet out, and the basket looked like a tri-state. And the old tri-state baskets had plastic chains that had a weight that hung in them. And you could hit those chains, it'd pull the weight up, and then it would spit the disc right back out. And as we're playing the hole, Mitch goes, "Gunner, just throw it in." And Gunner looks over and asks me, he says, "Are those chains plastic or metal?" And I said, "They're metal." And he goes, "All right," and slams it like 200 feet. I mean, so, you know, he could perform. He was kind of like him, you know, him and Mitch had a lot in common with Crazy John. They could perform on command. You know, they just had the ability to up their game to incredible levels. It was so much fun to watch them.
Yeah, it's funny. So about the players in the early days, because when you watch video, there's this misconception about the skill level of the players from the early days, because the sport has evolved as it's going to. You know, you have a pool of 10 times as many or 20 times as many players, you're going to get better players. You have a lot more people playing for longer and starting younger, so the game's evolved. But back in the day, people evolved their games for the type of courses they were playing at the time. So the techniques they play don't necessarily translate till today, but the techniques of being able to throw 200 feet on a rope, you had to do back then. You had to be able to throw 130 feet really well. I mean, everybody throws well now, but back in those days, the technique was just different. It was conducive to the courses. So what players could do back then on the courses at the time was astonishing.
Yeah, especially with the plastic we had. Some of the discs you had back in those days would explode on impact sometimes. You know, I mean, early on, Innovadisc, it seemed like every tree you hit, you had a different disc. And so you had to keep up with the game hole by hole. So the plastic nowadays is phenomenal. It's increased the level tremendously. And a lot of it, like you say, you know, we picked it up when we were in our teens and 20s. So kids that are starting when they're six, man, they got a hand up, and they're, you know, great fun to watch. There's nothing better than watching another guy throw an ace, you know. It pumps you up as much as it does them. And
give at least one thing better than watching someone else throw an ace.
Well, yeah.
Watching yourself. So this is the elephant in the room when Harvey's here. There was a tournament. It's one of the most famous, iconic tournaments in the history of the sport. A tournament called Oktoberfritz. And I'm going to tell a brief story, but I want to know about the history of it. But this is a tournament that I went to that, after Harvey and Bart told me all about it, I had never traveled much, but I flew from California to Kansas for this tournament called Oktoberfritz. And the way to describe this tournament was first prize in the open division was, I believe, $150. First prize for the most fun award was two airline tickets, a hefty bag full of golf discs. It was about $2,000. Now, remember, back then, $100 first place in a tournament was big. $200 was amazing. But the most fun award won like $2,000 worth of stuff. Is that about accurate, Harvey?
Sounds good to me.
Remember it. And winning the most fun award is the most prestigious thing at Oktoberfritz. And to win the most fun award, you had to break some laws, maybe not a lot of laws, but some laws. It usually involved nudity, alcohol, and it's story worthy. But anyways, that's Oktoberfritz, one of the legendary events. So, but how did that start? How did that come about?
Well, you know, a lot of that was really an offshoot of when we played Ultimate, because when you go to an Ultimate tournament on Saturday night, you had a party and everybody got to know everybody. Instead of like at a Frisbee or at a golf tournament, you'd go, you'd play, you'd go home, you know, or maybe you might see, if you stayed on a two nighter, you might see three or four people that you'd met that day in the hotel, but you didn't really get to know anybody. So we started doing Oktoberfritz, we wanted to bring that into it. We wanted to get everybody to get to know each other and have a little more interaction. So we started throwing a party, and we started out with you know, doing a Saturday, Sunday thing. Well, then when we were going to do the party, we thought, well, we need to break it to Friday. So we started doing some field events. And then, well, you know, really we need to do doubles. So we went to Wednesday and Thursday so we could do mixed doubles and doubles. And it just, all that stuff kind of evolved in there. And the most fun award, the idea behind that is one of the things Ed always said was when he would play golf, if he had fun, he always seemed to do well. So whether he was doing well or not, he would try to have fun, and that would lend itself to him doing well. So in that spirit, we wanted everybody to realize the most important thing was to have fun. You know, there were plenty of tournaments out there you could go to where the competition was cutthroat and everybody really, you know, was worried about every little thing. But at the Frizz, we wanted to give them a break from that. We wanted them to get to know each other and have an enjoyable round like it was when everybody first started, you know, instead of it being just about the win. And the nudity in those things weren't necessarily a prerequisite, but they never hurt, you know. And the more I landed, you know, like when Mitch Mack won one year, and Mitch Mack went through 6 costume changes. He came out to the party at first dressed up like a woman and told everybody he was Michelle McClellan, his sister. And then he left, and, you know, he was there for an hour. Then he came back, and he had a big, long trench coat on, and he was a flasher. And he had a fake 3-foot-long penis that would stick up when he would open his coat, you know what I mean? And then he was a Zulu warrior, and he was the Tin Man. And Dorothy and Kelly Warren and Lynn Warren were the his accomplices in that. And then he came in at the end dressed as a pole hole. And he was a fully functional pole hole. And we used him for the mini contest at the end of the night at the party. So, I mean, if a guy goes to those lengths, he deserves something for it. So now, we always tried to.
So, well, here's one important part of the story. Were these tournaments PDGA sanctioned?
Some of them, early on, they were. I had some, you know, the really my difficulties with the PDGA stem from the I'm pretty sure it was just a lack of communication, because I was sending my results, sending my check, they wouldn't print the results. Back then it was Joe Fike, Dog Gear Productions, doing the stuff, you know, the like Disc Golf World News is today. And it was the PDGA's newsletter, basically. And they never print our results. And then they sent me a letter telling me that I hadn't sent my check in. And I'm like, you know, I'm sitting here looking at the cash, at the check that they cashed, so I know better. And so then, well, next year it'll be better. So I did it again, and next year wasn't better. So I quit being a PDGA event. And then 3 or 4 years later, they came back, and they wanted me to be a PDGA event. So I said, well, if we're going to do that, by that time we'd grown from 30 or 40 to 300 people. And I'm like, well, if we're going to do that, we're going to have to be on the Super Tour, because I'm not going to be a lowly event. So they were okay. And I was supposed to get banners, and hell, I was supposed to get all kinds of stuff, and I never got anything from them. And so when it came time to mail them a check, I just forgot to mail them a check that year. And so that was where we fell out with the PDGA. And we wouldn't fit in now anyway, because we have some of our own rules. We always have. If you're playing and you throw a shot and the disc rolls back to you, that's a gift from God, and you get to throw it again. And if you land on top of the basket, that's good. We let you have that. Mm-hmm. And we let you throw 2 on the opening hole. Everybody gets to throw 2 shots, because, you know, we didn't warm up. When Dave and I first started, we would go to a course and just jump out and start playing. So our warm up was we'd throw 2 shots. So, and we call these rules windfill rules. And we use them every day, mm-hmm. every time we play. And we use them at the Frizz. And if something's in your way, at the Frizz, you can move it. If you've got a chainsaw, you can chop it down. You know, because I didn't want to be beat by someone, or I didn't want to beat someone because they were obstructed by a rose bush. You know, I wanted to beat them with my game. I didn't want to beat them by a technicality, you know. So if there was something in the way, it was something we just missed and meant to cut, go ahead. That's how we looked at it. So You know, well, it made for a more fun atmosphere.
Yeah, well, there were some other things. This is the early days of the sport. This is where there's going to be some modern people who are going to be mad at me for even talking about this stuff. But the early days of the sport were a little different. The year I was at Oktoberfest, it was PDGA sanctioned. And at this PDGA sanctioned tournament, with every scorecard each round, something came in the bag with the scorecard. You want to talk about that, Harvey?
Well, that was the what actually happened there. That was kind of a faux pas. We didn't have any pinballs. And so we figured we'd give everybody a joint. So and it was a big hit. And next year, everybody came and didn't want a pencil, you know. So that helped. Actually, oddly enough, that's one of those things that a little behind the scene things that Hell Marty and I spent 2 weeks twisting them up, getting things ready. And, you know, it's a little behind the scenes work that nobody ever gets to see. But it made everybody happy, you know. I mean, it sounds like something in Colorado.
This is the sanctioned disc golf tournament back in the old days of the sport. Now, the year I was there, Clint, the other McClellan, won the Most Fun Award. And what he did to win the Most Fun, this is still one of my all-time favorite stories. It was basically one evening, we were all staying at your house, and someone decided that Clint needed to eat a moth. Remember the moth?
Yeah, let me tell this, Scott. We're in my kitchen, and we're all standing around, and Gunner's got a big old jug of beer, and this moth flies up, and he catches it and puts it in his beer and chugs it. And we're like, ooh, that's pretty impressive, you know. And then he wanders off, goes, gets him another beer, and we're still standing there. And what these moths are, they're called Miller moths. They come out in June usually. And another one comes flying in the room, and Mitch Mack goes, Gunner, come in here, there's another moth, you got to catch it. And Clint walks in the door and he goes, I don't have to catch it, it'll come to me. And he holds his hand out and it lands in his hand. And he dumps it in his beer and drinks it. And now we're real impressed. And then, but about 15 minutes later, I go out back to get a beer off the keg. And Gunner's over there donating those moths back to my backyard. So, but he kept partying hard. And that night was one of those where it went about 3 a.m. And the next morning, I get up and I go down to start the tournament. And I mean, we're all blitzed. And Mitch comes up to me and he goes, Harv, no one's seen Gunner. He's gone. And I'm like, well, you know, we'll stall and give him plenty of time to show up. So we're stalling and waiting. And finally, here he comes dragging his butt up. And what had happened was at about 4 a.m, Clint had to go to the bathroom. Well, there were like 5 people sleeping in my bathroom. So you really couldn't get in there to pee. So he went out back. And he's pissed in my backyard. And when he gets done, instead of walking into my house, he walks into my next door neighbor's house. Walks back in the guy's bedroom, takes the blanket off of him, and falls asleep on his couch. And then the next morning, the guy wakes him up. And he looks at Clint and he goes, who are you? And Clint goes, well, who are you? And the guy goes, well, you must be one of Harvey's friends. And he goes, well, yeah, I am, oddly enough. And he gave him a ride down. He's the guy that brought him down to the tournament. And he was only about half an hour late, and we stalled, so that worked out good. But yeah, that was quite memorable. Anywhere else, you'd probably got shot. But that's when.
Yeah. So Bill, did you get to the early October frizz?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
I was at the first.
Do you have any memories from that?
Bill's been with us forever.
You know. There are so many stories about October frizz. Some of them we can't tell on TV. but, you know, they had chicken poop bingo. I mean, it was a carnival. And 4 of the greatest courses that you could play, it was a great time. All the beer you could drink, you know, they had 10 kegs. Typically, bonfires, campfires, everybody camped out. One of the best disc golf parties in the nation. One year it was the largest event in the nation. It was a huge, huge thing.
Yeah, 300. Yeah, you don't even understand what that was like. I mean, filling a tournament, a big tournament with 72, was that, I mean, back in the 80s, that happened a couple times a year in the whole country. And so this tournament would bring out 300 people. People would fly into it. That didn't happen very often back then, not for, you know, tournaments in Winfield, Kansas.
And I'll tell you, you know, there were 327 playing, but there were about 500 people there. I mean, okay. A lot of people came and partied.
Yep. Yeah, the campground was full.
Yep. It was rocking. You know, we've been flooded out. I mean, there's so many fun things that have gone on at the Frizz, the different things we've done. When we first started, we didn't even use any of the barns or anything. We were just over in the pecan grove because we didn't think the city would let us do anything. And then after the first year of that, Rick Myers, who was pretty much ran the parks department here in Winfield, came up and said, why don't you guys use one of the barns over there? And we're like, okay, that'd be great. So we started stringing tarps up, and we would string a half a mile of tarps around there trying to keep the wind out. And then after about 3 years, Rick's like, why are y'all using those? Why don't you use the indoors underneath the bleachers? And we're like, okay, great. So we went in there, and back then in Winfield, you couldn't drink beer within 200 feet of the grandstands, and which is kind of weird, but that's the way it was. And so that year, the party we held under there in the grandstands, and Rick came in on Sunday, and he's like, did you guys drink beer in here? And I'm like, well, yeah. And he goes, well, you can't do that. And we're like, well, we didn't know. So we won't do that no more. He goes, well, we'll just put you in a different barn. And they moved us to the barn we're in now, which is barn 5. It's the biggest barn out there. It's huge. And it holds all our banners. Every year we have a banner and everybody signs it. And we hang them up every year. So you can go in there and look. And you can pretty much gauge where you were and when you came and the people you came with. It's great memories. A lot of people that are on those banners aren't with us anymore. We've lost several golfers, you know, and we think about them all the time.
No, for sure. I mean, that's part of the, without turning this conversation dark, part of the idea of this podcast is I want to get some of the people on here that who can share some stories and make them a permanent record because they might not be here next year. I mean, none of us, there's no guarantees, right? So, especially your age, Harvey. I mean,
yeah, I'm like 92. I mean, come on.
You don't look a day over 80. So, I'm going to get better at this every time. So I'm probably an awful host, but who are some of the people in the early days of Kansas disc golf that these guys think it's important to mention because, you know, it's been, especially back in the day, it was a thankless job. I mean, are there some people that come to mind that really helped make it happen that you guys want to mention?
Yes, Voschel's.
Definitely. Ron Rice out west.
Big time.
The line of
guy that helped us get it going that I didn't really care for was Mark Jennings, and we should actually mention Mark because he did help a lot with the early formation of the KDGA. And Bill and Jeff Priest runs the Tick Ranch, and that's another great event. And him and Bill do the Kansas Scholarship program, and now we actually are donating money to kids to go to college. That's pretty impressive. You know, it's a long way from rolling hooters at a tournament.
Yeah.
You know, most of the areas that had disc golf were ran by a team of individuals. So to pick out one individual from each town would probably be a mistake. The Donaldsons, Clint and Shelley, sure. Up in Salina. Well, it wasn't just them. They had their posse of helpers and people who did things with them. So, and that was true of probably all of the areas where there were numerous individuals involved.
Yeah, you got to remember Bruce Hudson, Hal Beatty, Ace Mason.
Yeah, Ace Mason. You know, Dave Richardson down in Burke Patton, down in Winfield. Bob, Buddy Castor.
Bob and Danny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Danny Knox, that's right.
Yep.
Toolway.
Yep. Old Jack. Jerry Sherwood.
Tons.
Still around. Jerry Sherwood was with us for a long time, and he does a lot for the Wichita Club.
Jerry Sherwood?
Yes.
I was a player way back in the day and has been involved. Just a ton of them.
Yeah, no doubt.
The Foria crew, you know, Eric McCabe and the White Brothers, okay. And there was a Hutchinson crew in every little town that was first put on the map had a group of guys that, you know, Mace Man was involved. There were people involved in the sport.
Every little town had a league, you know, and then there was always a couple that organized it and got it all together, but it wouldn't have gone anywhere if it wasn't for all of them.
Yeah, I know. It kind of puts it, sorry, I put you guys on the spot because you're going to leave people out and then feel bad about it. So I'm sorry.
Right.
So my thought was that I generally want to, I think, probably keep this to an hour just because I think that, I mean, there's a million stories, but I don't want to keep you guys up. I know at our age, you know, we go to sleep early and get up at 5. So I want to just ask each of you, I'll start with Bill. What's your favorite story? Like, if you have one story to tell about anything to do with disc golf in Kansas, like, or if, by the way, if you have two or three, that's fine too. But is there anything that you just have to share?
I may have to think about that for a while. There's,
I'll give you one of my favorites. One of my favorite stories of all time. We were playing, there's a tournament that we played in McPherson. And McPherson's course has a little, it's like a creek that runs through it. And this creek's populated by black swans and ducks and geese. And we, several of the holes were laid out around this creek. So you would throw your discs in. A lot of discs got thrown in there. And earlier we mentioned Jack Robinson, Toolway. And Jack had thrown a bunch of discs in and he really wanted to get them back. So he was out in this creek, and he's about waist deep, and he's bent over perpendicular to the water, so he's like laying flat on the water with his arms down reaching for discs, and this black swan comes gliding up, and you know, we're watching and waiting to see what's going to happen. We think it's going to just honk at him or something, but it comes up and it swims right up behind him, and it lays its neck down where its head is right up by his head and just starts wing whipping the shit out of him. And Jack freaks out, jumps up, and he's like running on top of water. And this swan wing whipped him all the way to shore. And I mean, it's just things like that, little things that happen out of the blue that you couldn't script that stick in my mind. McPherson was always good for a story or two. I mean, something always happened there.
I have another McPherson story. Kelly and Lynn Warren were on their way home from their honeymoon, and they knew about the McPherson tournament, and they get there, we've probably four holes in, and but we're not going to not let them play.
Right.
They can make the holes they missed or take sevens or whatever the TD would decide, but Kelly gets in on my card, and on the very first hole, it runs alongside of a road. And, of course, that was one of the years that the wind was blowing like crazy from the north. So it was cold. And he throws his first shot, and it lands out in the middle of the street upside down. And a short hole, it paralleled the street on the right. And a car comes by, runs over the edge of the disc, stands it up, and the wind wobbles it to underneath the basket. And, of course, we allowed them, allowed him to have his deuce. He wasn't OB anymore. You know, that was the spirit of the play in disc golf in Kansas.
Sure.
I love it. All right, you guys, is there anything that we need, that you guys want to add before I let you get to our bedtimes? I'm calling it our bedtimes. I'm in the crew.
Hey, I'll tell you one thing I would like to say, Scott. I would like to see you include the McClellans when you go to Oklahoma. There's no one has a greater memory than Mitch Mack. Mitch Mack can tell you what he shot 4 years ago at Will Rogers on the in the second round, shot by shot. I mean, you got to go to Mitch Mack.
Oh, those guys, the thing about Mitch is he is one of the funniest people in the entire world without trying to be funny.
Hey, I got one story I got to tell, yeah. And Mitch will kill
Please
me.
Do.
He'll kill me for this. But Mitch and Johnny Mack and Clint were all going to go fishing with their uncle. This is back when they were younger. They just got into golf, and they Johnny Mack was lamenting the fact that he had had a baseball scholarship and had blown it off to get a job. And you know, each one of them had a little sob story, and their uncle's sitting there, and he looks at him and he goes, "Boys, we're McClellans. We're just stupid." And that sums it up. And we've always told Mitch we want that on a t-shirt. "Boys, we're just stupid."
I love that. That's awesome. All right. I don't want to like cut you guys off. We're all good.
One last thing.
This yeah, please,
is the 30th
please,
anniversary of Oktoberfrizz this year.
Is it really?
Pardon me? Yes.
The 30th annual Oktoberfrizz. I love it. And I'll give one last plug for what I'm doing in Kansas. Well, there's 10 events all on the Blue Power page, the whole schedule events this year. But Hayes, Kansas, 9th and 10th, we're going to have a great time. I'm sad to say it's not going to be as much fun as Oktoberfrizz, but it's still going to be a lot of fun, and I would love to see everybody out there. Dynamic Discs is sponsoring us. They're being a huge sponsor of the event. Discmania is on board, Gateway, and it's going to be awesome. So come on out to the event. Other than that, man, I love you guys. It's going to be it was an honor to have you guys on, and thank you for taking the time. And I'm positive everybody in Kansas is going to enjoy hearing this and hearing from you guys, because you guys are legends. So thanks a lot, you guys. Thank you a lot, Smashbox and Jonathan, for helping us out and helping get this off. I could not have done this without Smashbox behind it. Impossible. So thank you, Smashbox TV. Thanks,
Very
guys.
Cool. Love you too, Scott.
All right.